Welcome to Online Gods, a podcast about digital cultures in India and beyond. Today we're talking about scalable sociality with Daniel Miller and the logical Indian with Abhishek Mazumdar. Who am I? Who are you? Who am I to you? Most of you probably only know my persona through this podcast. Some of you also might know me through social media, either Twitter or Facebook. And some of you, heaven forbid, might even be unlucky enough to know me in the flesh. Right, in the flesh. I almost then said in real life instead of in the flesh, as if somehow my digital life wasn't real. But of course, it is as real as any of the other masks I pull on. I have a workplace persona, a family persona, a digital persona. I mean, actually, that's not even true. I don't have one digital persona. I have multiple digital personas, depending on whether I'm in dubious WhatsApp groups with my friends back from when I was a teenager or engaging in public debate on Twitter. And it's the coming together and separating of these different personas which ties together this month's podcast. As ever, we speak to two people. In the first half of the podcast, an academic about a certain concept or theory. And in the second part, an online god, someone who's doing something innovative or original in the online world in India. So in the first half of the podcast, we're going to be speaking to Daniel Miller, an anthropologist who recently concluded a collaborative and comparative research project looking into why we post. Especially, we're going to be talking about the project's concept of scalable sociality. And in the second half of the podcast, we're going to have this month's online god, Abhishek Mazumdar, one of the co-founders of the website The Logical Indian, a website which seeks to remedy the illogical mainstream media in India by publishing inspiring or worthy stories that they hope can have a positive impact. Regular listeners will know that now is about the time I tell you that this podcast is part of a wider project on digital dignity run by Sahana Udupat out of LMU Munich, and that you can and should get in touch via Twitter at OnlineGods, email onlinegodspodcast@gmail.com, and the website and Facebook pages of the project that's for digital dignity. I hope you enjoy the podcast. Now, as well as making this podcast, I'm often promoting or letting people know about things related to my work at the Central European University in Budapest. Students' work sometimes I'm putting out there, a different podcast that other people have made, events that we're organising, public lectures and so on. And because of this, a while back I signed up for one of those services that allows you to publish on multiple platforms at the same time, like Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, Twitter and so on. But nowadays, I never use it. And I never use it because I realize that in each of those places, I use a different language, a different tone. I have a different audience. I can't write something that's simultaneously for both academics and people with real jobs, never mind simultaneously for Indians, Central Europeans, and Glossopians. It just doesn't work. And I realized why when reading the co-authored book, How the World Changed Social Media, which is written by, and I apologize in advance that I'm going to mispronounce probably half of these people's names, but it's written by Daniel Miller, Elisabetta Costa, Nell Haynes, Tom McDonald, Razvan Nicolescu, Yolna Sinanan, Julio Speyer, Shriram Venkataraman, and Xinyuan Wang, which is from the aforementioned project Why We Post, which is led by Danny Miller. Danny is a professor of anthropology at the University College London and has been spearheading anthropology's engagement with the internet, the material, and the digital for many years. I'll put a link to a lot of his relevant work on the website. Currently, he directs the project, The Anthropology of Smartphones and Smart Aging, in which employs 10 anthropologists conducting simultaneous 15-month-long ethnographies around the world. And indeed, he's in the field right now, which is why I'm really, really happy to also have him on the line. Hi, Danny, and welcome to Online Gods.
Pleasure.
I really love simple questions that are difficult to answer. I know from the titles of the chapters in the book that you collectively produced, How the World Changed Social Media, it appears that you do too. So I want to start by asking you the question which forms the title of chapter one in the book. What is social media?
I feel that it would be not very helpful if we tried to create one definition of social media that works for everybody, because it is a huge phenomenon. However, it also is the case that if we're going to talk about it, for example, in my case as an anthropologist, people have a right to know what we think we are talking about. And so a definition that at least clarifies what we mean by it, or what it kind of does for us in terms of anthropology, is necessary. So in our case, what we have done is investigate a series of platforms in which people post and share. And indeed, the title of our project is called Why We Post. So clearly, we're looking at phenomena on which people create text, images, and other forms. In some sense or other, they post things. But for us, it's in a sense more important to understand what this is from an academic anthropological perspective. And we therefore need to situate it within the wider, if you like, ecology of how people communicate. Because people here are posting as a form of communication that clearly takes its place in relation to writing and to talking, to TV, and to every other previously established form of communication. So then the question becomes, defining it by what is different or particular, or how it has changed the possibilities of communication that existed previously. And in trying to make a clear definition of social media for our purposes, we therefore coined a term which we called a scalable sociality. And this works for us because it takes into account what previous media did and did not do. And the argument goes as follows, that previously most forms of communication were in one of two camps. They either were largely dyadic, so me talking to an individual person or writing a letter, which is usually to an individual person, or possibly a telegraph, and so forth. So you have simple dyadic, that means simply one-to-one communication. On the other hand, we see the history of broadcast communication. That is things like television and radio and so forth that went to anybody that happened to be listening at that time. Now, offline, it's always been possible to also have something in between those two, which is basically communicating with groups. So when I give a lecture, for example, when I'm talking to people in a small, let's say, gathering in my room, drinking at a pub with a few of my mates. So these obviously lie between the two. But if you look at the development of digital communication, online communication, you find that at first it tended to actually be, relatively speaking, individual or follow from broadcasting. But with the development of, say, email and then kind of web groups, etc., it was starting to colonize the space that was in between. Now, what we think about the significance of social media in all of this is that it actually grew from these two sort of poles to actually occupy everything in the middle. That is to say that a lot of the recent developments, the big new social media platforms, are things like WeChat in China and bit now beyond it in places like Southeast Asia. And then probably more familiar here would be WhatsApp. And these really develop out of messenger services that were originally dyadic. That is largely, you know, I send a message to you, so two people. But with WhatsApp groups and WeChat, et cetera, you develop bigger groups. And typically WhatsApp now might be used for, let's say, everybody in your family, or everybody who's in a football team and so forth. From the other side of it, and rather earlier, we saw that online was becoming used for broadcasting. So we post on platforms such as Facebook and Twitter and so forth. And typically, these were to audiences of maybe 100 or 300. So it wasn't to everybody. You either had to be a follower or you had to be a friend. So it wasn't public broadcast, but equally it was something very different from one-to-one. So now if you put these two trends together, the argument is that social media today is a series of platforms that allow people what we call, as our definition, scalable sociality, which means you can choose a platform that suits, say, talking to 10 people or actually broadcasting something to 1,000 people. And you can choose whether this is entirely public, i.e. anybody can theoretically follow you, or it is actually intended for only those people who've agreed and you have agreed to be within that specific group nexus, something like a family group on WhatsApp. Now, clearly, that is not a definition of social media that is necessarily of interest to other disciplines or from other perspectives. But social sciences and anthropology in particular have always been concerned specifically with the nature of sociality. So we're interested in how communication affects sociality, and therefore we felt that this definition of scalable sociality fitted the particular interest we had in what's changed with the rise of social media.
Really interesting. Thank you so much. That's a wonderfully concise summary of your argument. I was sitting reading your the book that you and others wrote inside the university where I work, and maybe academics are not the best people as a group because they're particularly maybe socially awkward at times. But one of them asked me what I'm reading, as people often do, and I say, "Oh, I'm reading the new book by Daniel Miller from this project." And then they said, "Oh, social media." And one of them said, "Oh, social media is just where people go to pretend they have friends." And the other person they're with says, "No, social media is what I use so I don't have to meet people I don't like, to pretend I have friends so I don't have to meet them." And I was reminded of that when I was reading your book, because maybe some people have this feeling of, people are somehow collecting friendships using social media, but actually it's a little bit more complicated how they're managing their relationships, isn't it?
Oh, I would say it's far more complex. And one of the big problems whenever people discuss new phenomena such as social media is that they have this terrible tendency to simplify and almost get rather nostalgic about whatever world existed before. So it's as though, in as much as when you are on social media, the friendship may to some degree be performed or faked, that meant that previous to social media, friendship was always kind of, real and authentic. Now, if you were to take a completely different situation that existed in everyday life, let's say the workplace, in the workplace, people were routinely friendly and often described people as friends. And actually, they were only in that relationship because they were, as it were, thrown together by the situation of the workplace. And in many ways, the day they kind of left was a day they were looking forward to, because they didn't have to spend any more time with people that in any other circumstances they wouldn't particularly wanted to be friends with. So actually, we have always had friendship as something that is both performed, that is faked, and that has many previous complications prior to social media. And in many ways, social media reflects that complexity rather than invents it. So it's rather that we blame the latest thing for phenomena that actually have always existed. And that's true for many of the different ways in which we use the word fake in relation to social media. But let me say something beyond that, because people tend to assume that social media has be responsible in and of itself for changing the way we experience friendship. So that friending as a verb, for example, with Facebook was not something that could have previously existed. Now, I wrote an article recently which makes more or less the opposite point. I would argue that actually friendship changed dramatically over the last 20, 30, 40 years in ways that had absolutely nothing to do with social media and online. The examples I give were that when I was a child, the dominant form of social relationship was kinship, as it has been for centuries. And one of the ways you know that is because we had something called fictive kinship, which meant that people were always being introduced to me as auntie this and uncle that. They actually were my parents' friends, but they were introduced as though they were kin, because that gave them more sort of authenticity and a stronger relationship than merely being friends. Whereas I hear people in the street today getting into a conversation with somebody else, and they say, "Oh, this is my sister, but also my best friend. This is my mum, but but also my best friend. And actually, what that implies is we've switched to what I would call fictive friendship. That is to say, friendship is now our approved, more authentic kind of relationship, because as everybody always says, you can choose your friends, but you can't choose your relatives. So we've gone away from what we now see as the burden of obligatory relationships, which is kinship, and we have this preference for friendship-like relations. Now, what follows from that is that in many ways, social media is actually acknowledging a much longer-term trend in the nature of the balance between kinship and friendship. So you can friend your relatives on Facebook, mimics the way that actually kinship has come in and been subsumed by friendship as the way we think of our social relations. And that suggests that social media is actually, if you like, cresting the wave of much more profound and deeper changes in the nature of relationship. Now, the problem is that that's pretty much the opposite of what everybody says about social media. They just assume, I think rather simplistically, that here is this new phenomena and it is always the cause of the change. I think it's the other way around. Actually, the causes are often deeper. We have relationships have always been extremely complex. And in many ways, the new online media are simply paying regard to it and acknowledging these underlying shifts in the way we relate to each other.
Thank you. I'm glad you mentioned family. Because this reminded me of a conversation in regards to family and politics online. I was having a discussion with a friend over summer, and he was telling me, he was actually complaining rather about his mum, saying that his mum didn't know how to do politics on Facebook because she kept getting into really blazing rows with like uncles or cousins and so on, to the extent that when they happened to have these family events, they were getting blacklisted or not invited to certain family events because, you know, his mum was getting a reputation for somebody, screaming at people online. So I was wondering, like, based on the research that you did and the other field sites within the project you mentioned before, Why We Post, how are most people doing politics online? Are they more like my friend who just stays out and doesn't want to really get involved, or are they doing it more like his mum?
I think they are, generally speaking, following the direction of your friend, and in many cases because they've had experiences similar to that of your friend's mum. So I think that story you've just told could be told many times in many places in the world. And one of the problems, I think, with the study of social media is it's vast. You can find anything you're looking for on social media. And so, of course, if you're interested in politics, you will find huge repertoire of political action going on through social media. But that's because you were looking for it. And one of the key points we make in our project is we don't look for anything. We just sit there for 16 months and try and observe what is actually passing through social media, which means we can put things into perspective. And one of the things that we noticed in several of our field sites is that actually, if you look at it from that point of view, there's a lot less politics going on than you might have expected. There's probably less political discussion online than you would expect to have online. And actually, the reason is precisely because people have noticed that when your friend's mum comes along there and ends up having these huge arguments about politics online, it's divisive. It has negative consequences for the family. And at the end of the day, these are social media. They're where you do have your friends and your family. So people have, by and large, decided that it is better to keep politics as something to discuss only sort of tentatively and rarely within one's social media, particularly when you're talking to your friends and your relatives. Because it can have those consequences, and it's more important to keep it as a kind of free social space where people can simply kind of, you know, develop what I think are quite genuine online repartee and friendship, and really keep away from politics. Now, obviously, there are vast numbers of exceptions to this, and there are places online which are essentially political. But if we're talking about the generality, what do most people do? then I think your anecdote is absolutely right. Most people have learned to try and be careful in their discussion of politics because it is divisive and that is problematic for something called social media.
And is there much then variation across platforms when it comes to that? Is like a certain place or certain platform? And I know I'm asking a general question, which is different in different countries.
Yeah, but... I mean, I think one of the key points that comes out of our work is really we need to be careful when we talk about the comparison of platforms. Because actually, there are many different kinds of Facebook and many different kinds of Twitter, depending on the community you're with. If we take something like Twitter, there are fields of Twitter activity which are essentially only about politics, and that is dominated obviously by the Trump and the Brexit issues today. There are fields of Twitter that are really about school kids having a go at each other, and if they do use politics, it's really just to say sort of often difficult and nasty things about each other. And then there are completely different areas where it's used for actually, making an exchange or as a key domain of friendship in itself between, a few people. So I think I'm cautious about simply saying, oh, it's Facebook versus Snapchat versus QQ. Quite often, you actually have to disaggregate each of these platforms. And one of the points we found was that, in fact, the same genre can quite happily often cross between the different platforms. So what was taking place on Facebook, because your mother started following you, migrates to Twitter. So that's important because otherwise we tend to think of the technology of the platforms as causative of their content. In other words, you get that kind of content on that platform because of the nature of the platform. That's not what we find. We find that actually, as in scalable sociality, there's a whole range of different platforms and people exploit them for all sorts of different reasons and in quite unexpected ways.
So that's a wonderful clarification. Thank you so much. For our final question, I want to ask you what we ask all our guests who come on the podcast. This podcast is part of a wider project where we're exploring the idea of digital dignity, whether discussions and interactions and relationships online can be done in a dignified way. And this is because often it's said that, questions about politics and religion and belonging can become quite nasty online. And I'm wondering, like, with this sort of vast comparative and almost normal place, and I say this in as somebody's from a tiny town that no one's heard of, research project that you've been involved with, what are the possibilities for having dignified discussions online?
Again, I think we have to be very careful because right from the beginning of the internet, and I was saying this in the first book I ever wrote about the internet, people who can't get taken seriously elsewhere or have extreme views, which nobody will post anywhere else, have always found it easy to post it online. So you tend to get this impression that there is all this kind of awful stuff there. Now, unfortunately, that has grown a bit more into the mainstream because the most prominent people to be discussed in relation to the use of social media are people like Trump, who clearly actually rather enjoy using social media in what most people would regard as a rather undignified way. But they are not the norm. So my job is not to look for these particular uses, but as I've said, to sit back and see what do most people do most of the time without looking for anything special. And actually, social media is, generally speaking, a dignified place in that if you take, for example, the work we did in southern Italy, you find that people there have very strong ideas about how Italian citizens should actually be in public. They did in terms of, how they would get together in the town square, but they are equally concerned that people should be respectable and show respect for each other. So they will dress to be photographed online with the same concern about the impression it would make on other people as they would offline. And that's not because they're being, narcissistic, selfie driven. It's quite the opposite. It's because they feel that Italians, as citizens, have a responsibility to be stylish, and they are taking their responsibilities quite seriously. And it is a place where people, do demonstrate their respect and concern for others as they would offline. And because these days the relationship between offline and online is pretty seamless, you know, you're talking to somebody one day on email, the next day you meet them, the third day you're on Skype, et cetera, et cetera. There is no real clear division anymore. Then you would expect the same concerns with respect and dignity to flow fairly easily between these different domains. And in most cases, it does. In other words, I would suggest that by and large, where people treat each other with dignity offline, they treat each other with equal dignity online. And the people that we know and can name who clearly use social media for what we would regard as very undignified purposes are just as bad when you meet them offline.
Wonderful. That's a great answer. Thank you so much for that and all your other answers today. It's been a real pleasure having you on the podcast.
Okay. Good luck with your project. And it was very, very generous of you to ask me.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the discussion as much as I did. One of the things that was really interesting, I think, was how much Danny emphasized choice, that we choose what platforms to post to. We choose what to post and what not to post when building a certain persona. And after the interview, I was wondering whether it's also true of news organizations who are driven to a certain extent by finances, the need to have clicks on the website and generate advertising revenue. How much choice do they have about the sort of stories that they post? Well, one person who believes very strongly that news organizations have a choice is Abhishek Mazumdar. And he is one of the co-founders of the website, The Logical Indian. The Logical Indian is, in its own words, a public-spirited digital news platform for the Indian millennials. Now, if you look at the site, you'll see lots of stories, opinions, videos, and posts that highlight social issues. For instance, right now you have a story about three boys who were wrongly accused of harassment, who were beaten up and shamed on social media and now can't find a job, about how somebody was sacked for sending abusive messages to women who worked for an IT company, about how a school dropout now designs textbooks for children, and about how rats have been blamed for ruining 200 bottles of beer that the police confiscated. Now, the website's been running since 2013, and it has a massive social media presence, with more than 6 million people following on Facebook. And I'm really happy to say that we now have Abhishek on the podcast. Hi, Abhishek, and welcome to Online Gods.
Thank you, Ian. It's absolutely my pleasure.
So let's begin with a little bit of, I suppose, your story, your personal motivation, because as far as I understand it, you weren't involved in the world of media or journalism, and then you started this site back in 2013. So what made you want to do this?
I mean, I would just want to bluntly put it as the sorry state of Indian media at this point of time. Now, as readers, as consumers of news, a lot of us, we always complain about that. No, this is not news, or this, you know, the media channels are stupid. They're showing this, they're showing that. But what are we doing? Like, if there's anything what we can do about it, I think that, you know, it's that simple. You know, I just thought of doing something about it, and hence started up with The Logical Indian. So initially, when we started, it was, we thought of just starting up the Facebook page first, and then eventually coming up with the website and app.
But why the name then? Why are you the Logical Indians?
Yeah, so, I wouldn't say that we are the Logical Indians, because it would be more like a self-proclamation. But the name behind the Logical Indian was, the intent is to speak out loud that we all should be logical Indians or rational Indians. We should not be the blind consumers of news or information, for that matter. we should use our brains, use our rational, and just not blind anything. I mean, just not consume anything blindly. So it's more of a message which we want people that, you know, be the logical Indian rather than claim that we are the logical Indian. It's mm-hmm. just that.
And so who are the illogical Indians?
It would be difficult to categorically mention a sect of people, but I would certainly say that anyone consuming news or probably building perceptions without knowing the facts are the illogical Indians who just blindly, you know, just probably follow news about whatever they hear and they believe it. And I don't blame people or the readers in general, because I understand that, you know, reading news is not the only job of someone in the entire day, right? So reading a news or probably watching television is just a part of the reader's daily life. Readers just want to consume the news, and you know, we would not want the readers to apply brains and understand. So it's our onus and it's our responsibility to ensure, like, do all the hard work and ensure that every news is presented, you know, all the sides of the news are presented, and obviously with perspectives.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, when I first started to see friends sharing your post, Indian friends sharing your post, like a few years ago, I felt a little bit worried because of the word logical. There's like a long story in the West of how, you know, how the West is the rational and the Asians are the irrational, you know? And I was like, oh my God, like, do you ever worry about this sort of framing?
I understand, Ian, but framings... it's not the only framing. There are multiple frames, and I just believe that no matter what the framings are or no matter what the perceptions are, it is about a generation. It is about a generation's, I mean, it is on a generation's responsibility, or responsibility would be the right word, to probably change these brackets, these narrations, or these, you know, this stuff. So I don't think that that's much of a worry, or probably the youth is much of a worry, because these things will change when you eventually change, right? If you are, you know, if there's a sect of people, forget about the East and the West, comparisons are, you know, at any fragment of population, any fragment of society, you have comparisons. So, you know, if someone is right, we all know that with the advent of fake news, and we had a lot of, you know, unfortunately, that's so unfortunate that in India there are so many killings and deaths, lynchings, mm-hmm. which happened just because of fake WhatsApp forwards. So just imagine, we live in 2018, and how sad it is that, you know, in India, you know, I'm just talking about in India, but obviously mm-hmm. there are other places as well, but people are getting killed in 2018, lynched, not killed, they're getting lynched by the mob just because of fake WhatsApp forwards. So now how sad it is. So now if you don't use your brains, if you don't bother to, you know, use your brains, or rather use your emotions, then, you know, that sort of framing kind of, you know, justifies your action. So it is on us, how do we change the framing, and if at all we are bothered about the framing. But if you look at the broader sense, it is everyone's responsibility to ensure that they consume news responsibly, mm-hmm. with responsibility.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what's interesting on this line is exactly what sort of stories you choose to put out there. So, I mean, somewhere on your website, you say that you want to put stories out there that matter. And obviously, you don't cover all sorts of news. It's like carefully, you know, collated types of stories. So I was wondering, how do you decide what matters?
So the selection of stories depends on the impact it creates on people. So it can be from politics, it can be the Supreme Court judgment, a Supreme Court judgment on any issue, or it can be an individual story, right? So, you know, we have a segment called My Story, and that is one of our most popular segments, where we publish stories of commoners, common people, because all of us probably we have our one, or, you know, inspirational incident or stories about ourselves. So commoners, that's called My Story and published in first person. So we asked them, we could contact them, and we asked them to, like, pretty much the way we are currently in the podcast now, we asked them to tell us their story, and we publish it in first person narrative.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like for me, this My Story section of your site is the one that I actually first knew about the site from, because they're the ones somehow that get a lot of traction, and you learn a lot, like, because you get these stories. And maybe I'm an anthropologist by training, so I'm interested in maybe individual life stories, but like some of the stuff is these completely, I mean, and quite short, but completely mind-blowing. I read one in preparation for this interview, you know, a Dalit child bride who became, you know, CEO of a and it's like, what?
Exactly. Thank you. Yeah. It feels great that you read that. Thank you so much for that. Yes.
Yeah. And then I remembered a conversation a journalist I had with a journalist a while back, and he was saying, oh, you know, like when they're trying to choose stories for their sites, you know, the problem is, you know, do you want to choose something which is worthy, or do you want to choose something which is newsworthy? Because he said, if it's too worthy, then it becomes boring. And I disagreed with him. He said, no, the worthier the cause, the less exciting you can write a story about it. So I wondered, like, do you feel this tension when you're saying, okay, that's a really great case, but where's the story? Or like, how do you deal with this in the newsroom, basically?
So that's a part of, I think that challenge is a part of any newsroom. So what we do is I'll just again mention that we try to focus on the impact, and as you rightly said, worthy or newsworthy. So it's a mixed bag. Since and most of the news media organizations, probably they suffer, or if as a reader, if you see that, you know what kind of news is this? This is so crappy. But how do they go live on those platforms? That's because probably the target or the goal which is given to the editor or whoever responsible to head the newsroom is the number of page views in a month. So to meet those page views, because the only thing which you have on mind is, no, I have to show a month-on-month growth on page views so that, you know, that ensures my growth in the organization, or probably my growth in the organization. If that's the criteria, then obviously you would actually see a lot of things, you know, getting compromised, because you look at the numbers, because a lot of things which are not newsworthy, unfortunately, get a lot of traction, which are not at all newsworthy, but they get a lot of new traction, or probably, you know, the one which I spoke about, entertainment, gossips and stuff like that. So one of the primary reasons these sections are in India, Bollywood, you know, that's a big thing. So Bollywood and cricket. So we do not cover any news about cricket. So it's nothing against cricket, but we feel that it's too overrated and everyone talks about it. So there are other sports we should encourage and we talk about. So I think that's the reason we were able to find a niche for ourselves. And that segment of people, those who used to always feel that, oh my God, India is all about Bollywood and cricket, or probably politics. So those kind of audience, they wanted something different, and there was always a vacuum which we were able to fill.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you say somewhere in your description that you want to be a democratized and approachable media, and this, and now I feel it from what you're saying here, but what does actually this mean in practice? What does it mean to be a democratized and approachable media?
When I say democratized and approachable, you know, I have seen over a period of time that whenever some incident, or let's say some college protest, or some, especially among the youth, if they come across something, the first thing it comes up in the head is, okay, let's reach out to the Logical Indian. They may cover it, or probably let's send it to them. They might get it covered. But there are the mainstream ones. There are the traditional media houses. It just doesn't click. That, you know, they feel that, no, you know, there's no point reaching out to the traditional ones, because probably it'll never be published. And I think that that's through the type of content you do, like, let's say My Story or any other stories for that matter. Whenever we publish, we source stories, we source the leads basically from not the entire one, I'm saying like a portion of our stories are always sourced from the emails and messages which people send us. And obviously, whatever emails and messages what we receive, it's not just we just believe it blindly, but we do our investigations, but we get the lead. And whenever we publish it, we reach them out. And I remember this, that when back in 2014, when we were just working out of, Homecom office setup, and we're just at the formative years, in a way, we're still at the formative years, but still, there was a time when we had two writers, like two guys responsible for writing it, and exactly two people responding to the emails and messages of the community members what we receive.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the comments under the site, and I can see from the types of stories you want to choose, and that you're trying to avoid being aligned with any political party or certainly any political movement. But of course, you don't exist in a bubble, and politics in India is extremely, whataboutery. it's full of like these sorts of comments. And I wonder, like, how do you negotiate these sort of, Congress BJP sort of clash? I know it's more complex than that, of course. Like, how do you negotiate this? Because often I see if you put something which is somehow critical, then see people say, oh, it's just another anti-Modi story again. Yes. And, how do you try to take care of this, or?
I think there's a very, very beautiful answer to this. And this is quite interesting as well, because, what happens is you may have, forget about the media space, right? Let's try to understand let's try to pull ourselves out from the media space and just think about your day-to-day life and the way you carry out yourself on a day. All of us must have faced this challenge that there are two facets of your personality. One is who you are, and the other facet is how are you perceived. Mm-hmm. Without the conscious effort, it is never, what you are is never equal to how you are perceived. That requires a constant effort. Be it like, you may be a person of, such and such nature, such and such behavior, such and such character. But if you do not put conscious effort, like if you just, you may have find friends that, I'm not that kind of a person. I don't know what makes you think that. So, we have always realized this because that's the game of perception, right? What you are and how you are perceived, there's a difference in between these two, and the difference can be blurred, or the difference can be eliminated through conscious effort. So now, while I say this, let's come back to the media space and your question. We know that our newsroom and everyone, we know that we try to be as rational as possible. We select news, and we give our heart, soul, energy, time, and everything what we have in every story and every copy we write and every story we publish. But that will not always translate. And people may think that, because it's a very practical thing. In India, when you talk about Congress and BJP, I think 80 or 85% of the Indian states are ruled by BJP currently, right? Apart from the center. Over a period of last 4 years, even the states, all the majority of all the states, they have BJP government. So if anything goes wrong, some crime happens or whatever, right? So when you report a news, you obviously question the authority, you question the government. Eventually you question the government, and that turns out to be a BJP government. So it's just, this question or this debate is ridiculous, because, I was in one of the IITs, and, I got the same question that, why do you always question BJP? So I said, it's not that we always question BJP. The thing is, do you think today there's any point questioning Manmohan Singh? Who was our previous prime minister? Or, to her, so it's just like that. If your current captain of your national cricket team is not, if your cricket team is currently not performing, will you question your present captain or you will question your ex-captains? Right? It's as obvious as that. And it's nothing about being anti something or pro something. It's about questioning, and that's the responsibility of the media. Media as a pillar, and if media doesn't question, who else? Because in India we have a very crippled opposition. You know, we it's as good as you know, we don't have any opposition in India. The opposition, I don't know. So that's the sort of state here. So media is the, you know, you just have the faith in media. The media will question and hold the elected representatives accountable. And tomorrow, if the BJP government changes, and if there are other governments coming in, then media's responsibility will continue to be the same and will continue to question the government accountable for that. So, you know, coming back to the conscious effort. So that's the reason. How do we balance it, or how do we, you know, still maintain the neutral stand? Is we put a conscious effort in, you know, digging out and pulling out the positive stories of the government. Because on a day-to-day basis, you know, like let's say this week, right, when you start your day and your edit meeting starts and suggestions come up and news, you whatever feed you see that, okay, this crime, that crime, this happened, that happened. And suddenly you see that your entire week went on the negative news and or probably questioning the government. So hence it requires a conscious effort that, okay, now you dedicate a resource, you dedicate, you allocate a team, or you dedicate a resource to find out the positive steps. And that takes conscious effort.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that brings me on to my last question that we ask all of our guests who come on the podcast. And it's just, there seems to be a moment now in, it's going on for a few years in India, and you're in your part of that, a shift from debate only happening in print media or TV and face-to-face, and debate happening online. So I was wondering, in this context, and we know how fiery things can get, and we also know how wonderful we can find stories as well, but is there a possibility for dignified debate in this sort of digital era in India?
You know, I would say yes. There certainly is an opportunity, and I have a lot of faith in digital media, because digital media holds a lot of potential. And the best thing about digital media, Ian, is, and if you look at the other, if you compare digital, you know, as a media format, as opposed to the others, let's say electronic media or print media, or probably the radio, the best thing about digital is, I'll just try to explain it with an example. Mm-hmm. So let's say there's a story of let's say a child in need, or probably an incredible boy with probably you know, amazing talent, some story of that sort, and you read, you watch that story on TV, or you read that story on a newspaper, on print. Now what happens is, you just read it, and then probably if 100 readers are reading it, then probably 80% of them would actually feel that, oh my God, it's you know, this guy is so talented, and you know, is there any way I can help this guy? But what happens is, in electronic media or in print media, the reader's emotions are high, but you're not able to capitalize on the reader's emotion. Immediately, probably you'll have some work, and then you just shut your TV, or you just, you know, close your newspaper, and just you go off, and you're busy in your day-to-day work. And then it's like, oh, I thought I'll do something, but you know, should I contact the newspaper? I don't know from where I'll get the contact. Oh, and then eventually nothing happens. But the best thing about digital is, and it's just one example I'm quoting in there, you can relate it to multiple examples. You can capitalize your reader's emotions immediately. On digital, you just probably you tag this story with a call to action, and you say, okay, if you want to reach this guy, you can contact this NGO, or probably this is this guy, this is this boy's contact number. Anyone wants to contact, just can contact directly. And we have, and this is a this is not a hypothetical example. These are real stories which we have done over a period of time. We partnered with a lot of NGOs and helped them leverage the digital potential which we have. We are fortunate that with the help of our community members, we were able to bring changes from awareness level to policy level changes in India. So that's something, mm-hmm. that's the potential of digital. You know, I just, you know, elaborated or probably digressed, but that's the potential of digital. So just about the debate or anything is possible in digital. And, you know, it's ultimately, it's just a tool, you know, it's WhatsApp can be used to spread fake messages and get someone lynched, and it's the same platform which can be used to probably infuse sense into this generation. So it's the same with WhatsApp, the same with Facebook, or the same with any digital platform. So these are just tools. Digital is a tool. Digital is a medium. So it's on us. It's on the humans how we leverage or how we utilize or how we manipulate those tools. That's about it.
Okay. Thank you. Well, thank you so much for that answer and for all your visits. It's been really great having you on Online Gods today. Well, I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Abhishek as much as I did. I think some of what he says links with the earlier conversation with Danny, although they put it in different ways. So, for instance, Abhishek says that the digital is a tool that we as humans use. And Danny's on a similar train of thought when he's saying that it's not that social media changed the world, but rather that the world changes social media. I think where they might differ is that Abhishek wants to work hard to close the gap between the perception of a person or a news site and the reality, that the sort of true self. Meanwhile, Danny is arguing that we craft different perceptions of ourselves in the eyes of others. And doing this digitally is, in and of itself, nothing new. Simply that we have front stage and backstage personas. One of the other interesting things that struck me in Abhishek's argument was that he felt a need to start the media site because of the state of mainstream news and political opposition in India. He saw it as sort of a democratic duty, if you like. And those who listen regularly will remember that the stand-up comedian Atul Khatri argued something pretty similar. He said he started to make political jokes because he felt that comedians had to fill a void in public life as others weren't doing a decent job. Now, after the interview, I wish I'd asked Abhishek a little bit more about the sort of binary he set up between the logical or the rational on one side and the emotional on the other. Because as I was thinking back about our discussion, I realised that he also wants to harness people's emotions for good causes. I think he used the phrase capitalising on people's emotions for societal or social impact. Anyway, that is something to think about going into the future. This podcast has maybe been a bit longer than usual. I hope you're still listening. Thanks again for listening, all of you who do. And thanks for all the nice things you write about us or to us. It's really nice to hear all this stuff as ever. I hope you have a great month. Ta-ra! Thank you so much for listening to the Online Gods podcast. Online Gods is part of the project Online ARPOL, funded by the European Research Council, starting grant agreement number 714285. The project's PI is Sahan Udupa, who's Professor of Media Anthropology at the Department of Social and Cultural Anthropology, Ludwig Maximilian University, Munich, Germany. I've been your host, Ian Cook. Goodbye.